Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's Friday, February 5th. The fun with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, the snow started here this morning across northern Utah, Wasatch Front, Wasatch Back, and we're continuing to see that fill in here at this hour as a storm system that is diving in from the Pacific Northwest is bringing in that snow through the rest of the day today. And right now, it's only going to get worse before it gets better because the snow is going to continue to pile up. And this will be a little bit of a better storm than what we saw just the other day. So we'll see the 3 to 6 inch range here for the Wasatch Back with this storm. Even a few inches on the Wasatch Front, which is hard to come by this year. So this is a better storm, a little bit better dynamics with it as well. 6 to 12 inches for our mountain and our ski resorts by the time everything's said and done here later this evening. But Parley's is going to be a mess. It's already becoming a mess. And I know a lot of those secondary roads in the Park City area are becoming a little bit tough as well. So that's just something to keep in mind heading out and about this morning and into the midday hour. So after today, you know, without maybe some isolated snow showers around tomorrow for the mountains, we are going to dry out and we'll start to warm up a little bit. We'll get into the mid-30s here for the remainder of the weekend, actually, in Park City after a 30-degree high today. And we'll more or less just kind of hang out in the mid-30s after that with a little bit more cloud cover here at times. But unfortunately, we'll be in a little bit of a dry stretch for much of next week until maybe the latter half of it where we see colder temperatures come in and another storm on the offing. But for now, it's getting through today, and so it's very important to be careful out there as that snow continues to pile up and roads become hazardous.
Okay. Have a great weekend. Thanks, Adam.
You too. Thank you.
And on the phone with us, with a look in the backcountry, we have Greg from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning, Greg.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you just heard from Adam. Today's storm is definitely going to be dictating not only the roads, but what's going on in the mountains. So we're expecting periods of heavy snow today and strong winds. Winds are really blowing at the mid and upper elevations. Gusting in the 30s, 40s, and at 11,000 feet, gusting at 70 miles an hour. So today we're concerned about a few things. One, the wind drifted snow, I think we're going to be finding fresh wind drifts at the mid and upper elevations. And when the winds are this strong, they're from the west and northwest, but they can drift snow on almost any aspect. So you really need to be looking for fresh wind drifted snow. About 8,500, 9,000 feet, again, on any aspect. And these can be sensitive because they've been landing on some of the colder, drier snow that fell over the last few days. Secondly, we're expecting some periods of heavier snow today. 6 to 12 inches are possible, kind of a wide range, but I think it's possible that we could have some periods of heavy precipitation. And if that does happen, you may find the new snow sensitive. We could get some long-running fluffs. And even some sensitive storm slabs. So watch for changing conditions, especially during any period of heavier precipitation. And what's happening is this wind-drifted snow and storm snow is falling on our buried persistent weak layer. This is that problem that exists mid and upper elevations, aspects facing west through north and east. We've had over 40 natural and human-triggered avalanches reported to the UAC from the Salt Lake and Park City Mountains this past week. And I think that the actual number is much higher than that. We just haven't heard about everything. So today's wind-drifted snow and storm snow is going to be overloading this weak layer. And if you do trigger an avalanche that fails in one of these buried weak layers, it could be up to like 5 feet deep, several hundred feet wide. So avoid slopes steeper than 30 degrees at the mid and upper elevations on those aspects facing west through north and east. And, yeah, we'll just see how the storm pans out. I would not be surprised if we actually saw some isolated areas with snowfall totals exceeding a foot. And going with a considerable danger, possibly rising to high if we do have that period of higher precipitation intensity.
Okay.
That's great. About it.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Later on, Park City Council Member Becca Gerber with a recap of last night's meeting. And finally, Summit County Regional Transportation Planning Director Caroline Rodriguez will be taking a look at some of those alternatives discussed at the County Council meeting earlier this week. Also, stay tuned. Coming up between 9 and 10, we'll have a wrap-up of that online Sundance Virtual Film Festival. We'll be talking with our Friday film reviewers, Barb Bretz, Linda Jager, and Mark Harrington, along with Salt Lake Tribune film critic Sean Mean. So we hope you join us for that. That's happening again today between 9 and 10. On the phone with me now with an update from Summit County Planning, I have Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see, any new applications worth noting since we last talked?
Going through my inbox this morning, a number of applications coming in. I mean, we get the traditional dozen, half dozen administrative low impact permits, but probably a couple of things to note. We have two condominium plats that have come in the Canyons Resort area. The first is the Pendry, the condo hotel that's being worked on. That's a really significant project in the Lower Village area. So we have the condo plat for that. And really what that signals is the work on that is beginning to point towards the home stretch. I think that project will be wrapping up this year with the intent of occupancy by the holidays. The other one is the White Pine Canyon Village condo, 30 units over there. So again, you know, all the work that's been going in and around the canyons, a number of those significant projects are looking to wrap up. We got a subdivision plat submitted for Silver Creek Village. It's going to be a phase called Silver Creek Village Elk Springs, 123 single family lots. You know, for the last couple of years, I think it appeared that there maybe hasn't been a whole lot of work going on over in Silver Creek Village. The truth is, it actually has been most of that being some pretty significant infrastructure installation. Garbett Homes has gotten busy with construction, and certainly, you know, Mountain Lands been successful bringing some product online out there. Elk Springs, this will be a big piece to that community out there. So that'll get started here in 2021. A couple minor plat amendments, people moving building pads. One conditional use permit came in. This is for a group home out in Highland Estates. The address, it's an existing home in the Highland Estates area. It's at 150 Highland Drive, and it's a organization called Roots, and what Roots is about, they provide home living educational services for young women who are struggling with depression, anxiety, trauma, mental health issues. And so what will be proposed here is converting an existing main residence with an associated guest house and garage into this group home facility. And it's looking like that is going to be headed to the Planning Commission as soon as the first meeting in March, which I believe is March 9. But that's really sort of the new items that have come in since we talked last.
Okay. Any big projects coming up on Tuesday's Planning Commission meeting?
Tuesday's Planning Commission meeting, we got kind of a busy docket, and it's a mix of both code and general plan discussions and project reviews. Probably that's more heavily weighted to the general plan and code review. We're going to go back and talk accessory buildings with the Planning Commission. We met last meeting and kind of took a deep dive and how can we best address, you know, these secondary outbuildings, you know, barns, riding arenas, you know, sheds that are out there. And we put forward a couple of strategies. We want to go back. We've refined that for the commission to review. So we're looking to get another round and hopefully some direction and a recommendation to council on that. We're going to begin the review of the general plan housing element. Jeff Jones will be joining us for that. So fine-tuning our our workforce and employee housing strategies. Now, that won't be direct code amendments, but this discussion and the decisions coming out of that will certainly lead to probably some future refinements to our housing regulations. Back at Silver Creek Village again, we've got a conditional use permit for a community park out there, which was sort of built into the original approval. This is just actually going back and reviewing the design of that, you know, what it's going to consist of. So the Planning Commission will be taking a look and hopefully action on that one. We're adjusting a lot out there as well. And then we're going to be reviewing the colony out at the canyons. The colony is looking to refine some language in the development agreement that applies to the homeowner association facilities and buildings. And so that's the meeting for February 9th. While we're talking Snyderville Basin, if I could, we've been receiving recently a lot of inquiries and comments on the Highland Flat project. That's the proposed development on Highland Drive near the interchange of US 40 and 80, where there's a proposal to build the apartments, the stack flats. That item is going to be going to a public hearing at the second meeting in February. That's going to be February 23rd. We had a big work session on this project prior to the holidays. There wasn't any public comment taken at that meeting, albeit a lot was received. This will be the community's first opportunity to provide input and comment on that on the 23rd. So a busy February for us.
Okay. The county issued a press release announcing the waiver of building permit fees to encourage the transition to electrified transportation and renewable energy, like installing solar panels. Haven't we been doing this for years now?
Oh, we have. For the last couple of years, we have been waiving fees for people who have been installing solar, both, you know, roof-mounted and ground-mounted. And we have actually been permitting EV charging stations, the majority of them at public facilities. You know, is it a huge fee for these things? You know, it depends on the nature of the specific permit, but I think they probably average around $350 for a permit for that type of activity. And we probably issue around 80 to 100 of those a year. So we think it's an appropriate step for the county to be able to provide that type of incentive. Sustainability initiatives really high on the council's strategic goals this year. It has been for the last couple of years. And anything that we can do to help reduce or take down the hurdles or the obstacles to make this sort of technology available to private homeowners or the public at large, we see it as the right thing to do.
Hey, let's see. Can you give us some idea how much money this would involve, though?
Help me out, Leslie, in terms of money, what permit revenue or?
Well, it would involve for the resident or the developer of the, you know, the resident putting it on. I mean, is it, how much of a savings, I guess, is what really what I'm asking.
Boy, I probably wouldn't be the right person to answer that question. Okay. And not to deflect. I think that would probably be a better question to be fielded by our sustainability manager, Emily Quentin. Sorry, couldn't be better at answering your question. Again, it really depends on the scope of the work involved. We're just trying to, again, reduce the hurdles for people to actually take use or benefit of that sort of technology.
Okay. The Eastside Planning Commission had a discussion last night about the code and trailers, but did not come to a decision. The background on this is that the county is getting complaints about single-family lots in areas like Samick and Manor Lands that are hosting, apparently, campgrounds or multiple RVs getting parked there. So is that not okay? Is that not allowed under the code?
Well, I don't think the code is precise enough, to be quite candid. And I think we're making some really good progress on that. Again, this is probably the fourth discussion we've had with the Planning Commission on this topic, and I think we're making some real good progress. Here's what I gleaned from last night. In terms of commercial campgrounds, the Planning Commission is probably going to be making recommendations to the council that commercial campgrounds do not take place in residential subdivisions, that they probably need to be in specific areas. And they've been working on a recreational commercial zone. We're going to be going back in about 6 weeks to actually take up that topic. We had an initial draft about a year and a half ago, and then we got busy on other items. We hadn't advanced that. I think the commission sees commercial campgrounds need to be in a commercial area. Private campgrounds need to be in specific zones as well. So the smaller zoned areas of Eastern Summit County, I think what we're going to find is a recommendation coming out that those shouldn't be, those won't be an appropriate location as well. Where this really kind of boils down to is, can somebody have an RV or RVs on their small lot, sort of in, you know, up Weber Canyon or Uinta Lands or the Bear River area. And so here's the direction that I think we are headed. Property owners will be permitted to use RVs to camp on their private property. They'll be allowed to have up to two. Now I'm going to talk about some exceptions here in a second. So they'd be able to have two RVs to camp in on their private property. If those RVs are hooked up to a wastewater system, an approved septic system, and they have power and water, they would be able to use those two RVs for camping for up to 14 days within like a 1 month period. If they're not hooked up to a septic system and a water system, then you'd be allowed to use those for 3 consecutive days within a month. And the idea behind that is you know, you'd be able to accommodate your wastewater probably in a holding tank. Now, there would be a couple exceptions to that rule. And, you know, this was kind of the product of a whole lot of discussion. You know, the question came up, well, what about, you know, people come up for Pioneer Day or Memorial Day or the 4th of July, they have a family reunion. Well, there would be, you know, the opportunity for a 1 week period where you could have more than the two RVs for the family gatherings. The code as proposed to the amendment would allow for the storage of RVs. One of the other problems that were brought out was it was sometimes more than just people camping in RVs. You know, it was really boiled down to like, you know, a junk ordinance problem. And so what we're probably going to be coming back with as well is a junk ordinance that's more akin to what we have in the Snyderville Basin. And that would be finding its own way into the code as well. So I thought we made progress on that last night. And again, I'm looking at probably one more meeting with the Planning Commission before that's wrapped into a set of overall recommendations.
So whatever happened to the individual application then that brought this up in the first place? There was a couple that wanted to put a trailer and a structure on their lot at Samick.
I know there's one of them going to be coming back to the next Planning Commission meeting on the 18th. So I'll report back next month how that one turned out.
Okay. Quickly, an update on Dakota Pacific. Last we heard from the Summit County Council, they wanted to create some subgroups. Have these been created?
They have. We appear to have 4, or if you include the discussion on the phasing, there would be 5. So the first subcommittee group would be reviewing uses, the project density, the site plan, the design guidelines. That will be staff and Doug Clyde and Chris Robinson. sustainability. Glenn Wright will be the subcommittee member for that. Traffic, transportation, transit, that's going to be Glenn Wright and Chris Robinson. Housing, Roger Armstrong and Melena Stevens. And then phasing, I guess you wouldn't call it a subgroup or a subcommittee if all of them were going to be involved, but any discussion that would talk about bundling all of those elements into some sort of a phasing plan, they want to do that together. So that's the subcommittee groups, and it's a technique that had been used in the past. There's actually, you know, a fair amount of precedent for doing it that way, that being a small working group of council members sitting directly down with staff to basically do a deeper dive into the analysis, you know, look at some potential problem-solving mechanisms or explore some options. We've done that at the Canyons, probably the most recent example, when the Lower Village Master Plan was revised a couple of years back, was done for the Promontory development, Lincoln Station, the development agreement. We use this sort of approach. And, you know, going back to the tech park, at one point in time when the Boyer Company still owned the property and there was interest in revising some aspects of the existing development agreement, mostly the design guidelines and some of the uses, we employed this as well. I think it's probably important to focus on a couple things. One, this isn't council sitting down with the applicant or the developers, council sitting down with staff. There's no deliberations, no decisions are made, no negotiations going on. It's really about getting back to spending time outside of the meeting dealing with the more technical analysis. And so coming from the subcommittee meetings, they will go back, you know, in public meetings, you know, other council meetings, and report back to the rest of the group on what they found, what they've determined, or what they see are some possible options or solutions. So I think we're going to get started on that process here pretty quickly.
All right. So the fact that there's not a quorum of council members, that means that the meetings are not public. Is that what you're telling
correct.
Me?
Correct. That's correct.
Has the staff made a recommendation on this project? And will it, if it hasn't already?
Well, staff made a recommendation on the project earlier when it was in front of the Planning Commission. So that evolved into the Planning Commission's recommendation. And again, the Planning Commission ultimately recommended denial on that. So at this point in time, the council's evaluating both of those recommendations. But really, the one that they're focusing on now was the recommendation that was made by the Planning Commission. And like any project of this nature and magnitude, they've taken the opportunity to open it up, I think, from the very beginning and do their own evaluation.
So
there's a lot of work and a lot of discussion left on this.
So the staff's recommendation was in favor of this project as
yes.
proposed? Okay. I got to leave it there. Pat, hey, thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure to talk, Leslie. Thank you.
Well, on the phone now with a recap from yesterday's Park City Council member. I have Council Member Becca Gerber. Good morning, Becca.
Good morning.
So after a presentation by the library staff yesterday, Council wants to look into gradually reopening the library. You know, we've had restaurants and grocery stores open. Why couldn't we open with the library with COVID restrictions in place?
You know, my understanding is, so they actually did reopen in June and we're just cleaning everything after everyone came through, but with the elevated risk level, when we went back from moderate to high risk, they were in line with other libraries in the state and didn't feel that it was safe to keep it open. They really relate the library more to, you know, the community's living room where people come and they browse and they touch everything. And it's really hard to maintain that level of safety that they felt was really important for our community.
Okay. So we've learned a little bit more now about the virus. So when are we talking about reopening?
So their benchmarks are really based on the risk level in that the health department is setting. So once we move to moderate, they feel that they will be able to maybe start moving towards having some of those open computers, open some of the different facilities. But it's really in line with once our COVID levels go down, they have a benchmark set to kind of each risk level that the that we hit as we move through those high risk, moderate risk, low risk. And it, by the time we get to low risk, it seems like we would essentially be open.
So no real timeline then in terms of that.
Yeah.
We just kind of a wait and see kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's something you can't really set on time. It really has to be based on the risk level in our community. And so, especially since, you know, our library is very highly frequented by seniors. But one thing that did come up at the end of the discussion was, you know, as more of our senior population gets vaccinated, as more of our community gets vaccinated, can we have opportunities for those that have been vaccinated to come back into the library a little sooner? And that's something that they're, you know, they hadn't had a chance to discuss, but is something that they said that they would think about and come back to us with.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, it's like if you could, we got big, tall, bookshelves, you know, that kind of block people from one another, you know, probably much more so than a piece of plexiglass would. But, you know, I mean, again, grocery stores, you know, people are checking out the apples and, the, you know, and the oranges and stuff. So I just don't see why there's some concern, yeah, you know, about people touching things in a library.
Well, I think some of the concern is also that people tend to sit, you know, want to use the computers. And when you're sitting in one spot for a long period of time, if you have someone else sitting near you, that I think tends to increase the transmission. And I mean, honestly, I'm not the COVID library expert, but I do think that they have presented their benchmarks to the Summit County Health Department. And they feel, Rich Bulla and Phil Bondurant felt like these were good benchmarks to set and are also very much in line with libraries and the rest of the state. And I mean, I will say personally that I miss being able to go to the library and take my kids. It's such a wonderful resource for families, as well as seniors and just people who don't have computers at home. I don't think it's something that we're intentionally holding back from the community. There really is a concern about keeping the public safe and keeping the staff safe.
Okay. Arts and Culture District Council spent several hours discussing affordable housing at the district. Consensus on some aspects of the project, but council was split on others. One thing councilors agreed on was prepping the property for eventual construction. So how quickly can demolition start? I guess I thought it was starting back this fall.
You know, all the buildings are empty at this point, but they're all still standing. I'm not sure, you know, how long exactly it will take from our go ahead last night to get the graders in the ground and begin demolition. But I think our hope is that we can get that part done. And then whatever happens by springtime, we're ready to move forward in one direction or another.
All right. So we're pushing it back till this spring then.
I mean, I don't know. They could start demolition sooner than that, but I think the goal is to have it prepped by spring.
All right. You agreed with Councilmember Nan Worrell that all of the back and forth on the project could make the Sundance and Kimball Arts Center partners, but nervous about writing the city checks for their parcels of property. Nan calling it a chicken and egg situation. Do you think the council should commit to moving forward with the project so that we can encourage these two nonprofits, or should council wait for firm commitments from them first?
I mean, this is a tough one, but I think from my perspective, we have heard nothing but that our partners are committed to moving forward. And the hard part is, you know, we've committed to, when we bought the property, we committed to doing an arts and culture district. And housing was a part of it and parking was a part of it and doing the layout and kind of having an area that was dedicated to arts and culture was the plan. And if we as a council are moving away from that, I would think that it would be hard for them to commit to. They didn't commit to being in a commercial district or in, you know, a parking lot. So I think that we also have an obligation to move forward with our planning and make sure that we're being good partners to them as well. So it is a bit of a chicken and an egg. You know, we all kind of have to, as Max said, we all have to be willing to take this jump together. And as we kind of hesitate about what we want to put in the area, I think that it's natural that that might cause some concern amongst partners.
Yeah, certainly one aspect of the project that council was split on was whether housing really does need to be a part of the project. So with the construction costs going up, is housing at the district a deal breaker for you? Or are you open to constructing the units at perhaps another more cost-effective site like a Homestake or somewhere else?
You know, I really feel that the housing adds a lot to the site. And I also very strongly, in addition to the fact that I think we'll add a lot of vibrancy to the Arts and Culture District, when we talk about housing, there's just very little space left to build. And I know we've expressed a lot of regrets in the past about not having taken advantage of building levels of housing on top of other developments in town. And I feel like this would be a missed opportunity. So for me, it's not, do we build at the Arts and Culture District or do we build at the Homestake? It's, I think we should build at both. And, So that's really my opinion, is that I think that we need to have the housing at the Arts and Culture District because we need the housing overall in our community.
Yeah. Councilmember Steve Joy said the situation isn't necessarily one of can we, but should we? So it sounds like you think that this is the right project for Park City right now.
Yeah, I mean, it is going to be expensive. Housing is really expensive to build. And I think, you know, I spent this last Thursday and Friday in virtual meetings with our counterparts in Colorado at the CAST, Colorado Association of Ski Town meeting. And housing was the number one topic of discussion for both days. It's difficult in ski towns. It's difficult in urban settings. I mean, I think one of the things that the pandemic has really brought to light is just how housing affordability has really reached a crisis in our country. And if we want to have a workforce in the future, we just have to be willing to buck up and do it. And it's going to be expensive and it's going to be hard. And I'm hoping that there's opportunities for us to work with partners. And that's been a big discussion. We have a group right now that is working with some private developers and some of our nonprofits to see what opportunities there are to take some of the costs off the shoulders of the city. But, you know, should we be building housing and should we be taking advantage of every opportunity to build housing in our community, whether it's us or working with partners and private developers? Absolutely. I think that this is not something that we can pass on. And I feel very strongly that we need to take advantage of every opportunity and every space we have to build it. And there are some other opportunities around the city, but I just don't feel comfortable giving up a space because it's all going to be expensive and it's all going to be hard. And as we've seen over the past few years, every space has an issue that we've looked at working with. So yeah. I think at some point in time, we just have to gain the intestinal fortitude.
Looks like we lost her there. We're going to see if we can get her back.
Uh-oh, did I disconnect?
Kinda, yep, okay, but you're back. Okay.
Okay.
But let's, so I guess what I'm hearing, so there was certainly some back and forth about mixing market rate rentals in with the units, perhaps more commercial options to make the construction more feasible. Do you think that we back off of that and just go forward with building expensive, affordable housing?
So I think that there are some opportunities. We talked about having market rate rentals, and I actually feel more comfortable having a market rate rental than a market rate for sale unit. So that was part of the discussion we might move forward with. Right now, there's almost no rentals at all. I think there probably are no rentals in Park City proper. So even having a market rate rental is more affordable than, or is at least an option for someone. So there's that option. We did talk about maybe having some of the buildings 2 and 3 have some commercial space that we could get some return on. So I think that we're still putting things on the table. We're not taking things off.
Okay. Also wanted to bring back to you the new LGBTQ plus task force was rolled out last night. One thing that was brought up during the public comment was how even though Park City is seen as a friendly place for LGBTQ people, there really isn't a sense of community here for them. Can you tell us who can join this task force and how you think it could help us move in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was just such a wonderful part of our community, of our meeting last night. We had It's such a great presentation by our city social equity team, and we were joined by the GSA Gay Straight Alliance from the high school. And as Lynn Werpeek said, you know, it was kind of surprising to her to see that the only, you know, organized support group for our LGBTQ plus community was at the high school. And so this task force is just being rolled out. As she mentioned, it has been an internal task force, and now we're really rolling it into an external task force. And it is open to our community to join. We, you know, we got some good feedback that we really need to let our LGBTQ plus community lead the way. And I think that we would love to hear more from them and have them really get engaged and involved in this process. And that would be, I think it would be great to have them lead the way. So hopefully we can kind of be, the city can kind of help be this spark to get this, you know, campfire going. And there is information on the city website as to how you can get in touch with Lynn Werpeek and Jolene Weston, and also our new city liaison is Leah Langan up in the administrative office. So I think that all of their contact information is on our city website. And I also believe they started a Facebook page. So hopefully we can really help create community in Park City. And I mean, it was a really great hearing from so many LGBTQ plus members of our community, and the presentation by GSA on pronouns was outstanding. So I know that the meeting was recorded on Facebook live last night. So if anyone in our community is interested, I would go back and listen to that presentation. It was really well done.
Wanted to ask,
but yeah, it was a great part of our meeting last night.
Wanted to ask you about the low scores that Park City received on the annual Human Rights Campaign Municipal Equality Index. A 37 out of 100 last year. City staff said it would be virtually impossible for the city to score a perfect 100 just because we're a smaller community than many of those participating. Any idea what is a more realistic score, though, to shoot for in the future?
Yeah, I think Jolene Weston mentioned that, you know, there were some clerical errors and some reporting errors that the city made in I guess we were supposed to turn in some more information on our insurance policy that we did. And there were some other areas that we should have gotten some credit for that maybe we didn't. But she said that the highest we could possibly get, she thought, was a 72. And she thought that if we had revised some of our clerical or reporting errors, that it might have been, our score might have been closer to a 63. So our goal is that 72. And I think that there's a lot of confidence in the city that we're going to get there.
Okay, so it sounds like they were pretty nitpicky when it came to what they were looking for. So our score of 37, you don't think it accurately reflects our efforts then?
Not really. I think, you know, they mentioned that there were some areas where our community is just really too small to peeing on their scoring system. You know, I think there was one thing about hate crimes where we scored zero because we don't have any hate crimes, which you would think would be a good thing, but apparently it's how you deal with them that maybe makes a difference. So we got a zero on that. But then, like I said, on other things, it was just, you know, we didn't turn in the full transcript of all of our insurance policies, and they want that as opposed to just a brief segment about what you offer. So there are definitely some ways we could really bring that score up. But it's also, I mean, I think that it's been a great opportunity for us to, as Lynn Werpeek mentioned, to see what other communities are doing and what we should be doing to make a more inclusive community. And when you use it kind of as a guiding star, it's really helped us move in the right direction. So I think, you know, the 37 is just a number, and we very much believe that we are moving in the right direction. And, you know, that's the goal. If you have a perfect 100, you're not really incentivized to do anything new. So at least we have a lot of incentive to do more and to be better. And hopefully we'll keep moving in that direction.
Okay. So you do think it's valuable then to participate in the index?
Oh, yeah. And it's also, I mean, I think the other thing that was mentioned last night that was that Aspen's score is 61. And so just to even get a little competitive and beat that 61, I think that there's a lot of drive at the city for us to move forward.
Okay.
And it was, again, hearing from so many members of our community that were interested in being a part of this task force was I think, really important step for us, too.
Okay. Beck, anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it. Yeah, we're back again next week with another discussion on the affordable housing. We're adding a meeting to our calendar so we can circle back on that conversation. So we'd love to have more community join us and provide feedback on their thoughts on this. This project is big and it's a lot of money, but we're still plowing through these discussions, and the more feedback we get, the better the project will be in the long run, we believe.
Okay, Becca Gerber, Park City Council, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, for alternatives for the future of the Kimball Junction traffic mess that we've got were reviewed by the Summit County Council on Wednesday. On the phone to look with a look at what's next, I have Summit County Regional Transportation Planner Caroline Rodriguez. Good morning, Caroline.
Good morning, Leslie.
So based on what I heard, it sounds like the only alternative worth moving forward with may be alternative three.
I think I would put it in sort of different terms and say that the alternative that the council is most interested in, and that echoes what we've heard from the public through our survey response, is alternative three in the long term, with some pieces of other alternatives added into that as we look deeper into the analysis.
Okay, so let's back up just a minute. Who came up with these alternatives? Is this UDOT's work product here?
Actually, it's a combination of UDOT, Summit County, Park City. We have a whole host of people participating in this. I think our technical advisory committee, which is made up of technical staff from various agencies, has over 35 people participating. So it starts off as really a brainstorming and a huge range of alternatives that could work. And then it's whittled down through these two levels of screening.
Okay, so you do have some direction from the county council. What happens now in working with UDOT?
Yeah, so now we go back to UDOT and our project team, and we will be giving them council's feedback. And luckily, council's feedback is pretty much a mirror of what we saw through our survey results. And that type of feedback actually scores very high in our waiting process for the screening. So we'll screen out those alternatives that are not acceptable, and we'll move forward with a really micro level modeling and data analysis of the alternatives that are acceptable to the community and council.
So the route that was intruding into Hyute Ranch seems to be dead. However, Councilmember Doug Clyde mentioned that he had an idea, and that is just to take the road to the east and expand on that. Is that feasible?
I don't know if it's feasible because we haven't done the analysis, but it's definitely something we're going to look at. Even just moving that road, I don't know that the traffic mitigation would rise to the level where that alternative would even move forward. Again, the purpose of these exercises are, these are not plans that we are going to implement. This is a range of alternatives that we are testing in terms of traffic mitigation, and does it support BRT, and is it acceptable to the community? And I think what we heard is, on a few different levels, that road, it really doesn't work. It really doesn't make that much of an improvement.
So this alternative three, is this the idea that has been bantered about for years? I mean, that we would basically have new flyovers to get to and from Interstate 80 without having to go through kind of the commercial area?
A little bit. It's a play on that. They're not flyovers from the interstate. It's that 224 is depressed going through Ute and Olympic, so that if through traffic doesn't need to hit in any traffic lights, and local traffic does that east-west movement at street level.
Okay, so basically what we are doing is keeping the 224 in place and digging under that?
Yes, 224 itself is depressed.
Okay. I guess, did a price tag come with all of these alternatives?
Nope, no price at this point other than magnitude of dollars. If the cost was estimated to be astronomically high, it would have been screened out in level one. If it's anywhere within reason, it potentially could move to level two where we are now. And then as we move through level two and finish that screening, we will have a better sense of cost. And then that will move into the next step of the process which would be an environmental, and that really gets down into dollars and cents.
So if, in fact, I mean, we move forward with one of the more expensive ones, I mean, is it that Summit County has to pay for most, if not all of that?
Nope, no. It's just we need to further develop the design to understand what the true costs are. It's just part of the process. Nobody is committing to paying any cost.
All right. Since some local leaders are pushing to become a carless society, I mean, we're even seeing code amendments that would allow fewer parking spots and new developments. Which of these alternatives gets us there? A plan that is not about making it easier for those driving their personal vehicles, but in fact discourages cars and promotes public transit?
Well, I think all of these plans, the purpose and the themes and goals in each of these alternatives was to support public transit, especially the bus rapid transit. So each of these have components that support the carless lifestyle. I would say, you know, alternatives 3 and 4 go pretty far in terms of providing walkable, bikeable, and transit supportive neighborhoods, especially in Kimball Junction. But each of the plans contemplate a transit supportive environment. And, you know, just because we want to be transit supportive and moving towards carless, that doesn't mean that we want to totally eliminate cars, because that's not reasonable for every single person in our community. We just want to make it easier for however you choose to travel. We want to make your commute or your trip easier.
So alternative 3 then, I mean, does it allow for more cars on the road without getting to, you know, the cluster that we have now?
It doesn't allow, I mean, it does allow for more cars, because we are looking out to 2050 to make sure it can handle the capacity. And the reality is there is going to be an increase in traffic volume no matter what we do. But what alternative 3 does is it creates a facility that makes it easier to separate out the traffic. And especially because about 50% of the traffic in the Kimball Junction area is not through traffic. It's trying to get to the businesses and opportunities on both sides of the neighborhood. So what the alternative does is it pulls off some of that car traffic and transit traffic and makes it easier for them to get to both sides of 224. So it's not a pinch point right at those two signalized intersections.
All right. Alternative 4 is about short-term fixes. Can you talk about what some of those fixes are, and could they be done, you know, as soon as this year or next?
Yeah. So I think that's exactly what we're contemplating in coming out of this level 2 screening, is that how can we implement some of these alternative 4 solutions in the short term, not instead of a bigger fix, but as we work our way up to maybe a bigger solution, such as alternative 3. So that includes some things like adding triple northbound left turn lanes in some cases, or a pedestrian tunnel under 224 at Ute, or widening the northbound lane on 224 between Olympic and Ute. And it's those types of things that, yes, could be implemented fairly quickly, and in the entire scheme of things, they're less expensive than other solutions maybe would be.
Yeah, but if it sounds like, so when you're starting to expand 224, we're talking about, you know, depressing 224. So it sounds like we're doing the work, and yet we're going to be doing it twice. Then if we
it's
were to go,
that we're doing it. Yeah, it's just a widening in that short area between Olympic and Ute. And that would be something that would probably be a stepping stone to depressing it anyway, just because of the excavation work. Again, that will come out in the further project development and design, but we would not do anything that would require duplication of costs work or prohibit us from making these bigger changes, you know, in the longer term.
Okay.
So all of these changes are contemplated in the context of the bigger solution.
And doesn't preclude any of the other alternatives from moving
forward.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I wanted just real quick to talk about the board has been appointed for the Centerville Transit District. So what happens now?
So So now we will start having regular public meetings, just like people see the county council does, and we'll see those. They'll be advertised and open to the public. And because, you know, we're starting from a sort of almost from scratch, we'll be having a lot of administrative work at those meetings come through, such as, you know, signing insurance documents and things like that. But we'll also be reviewing some of the market analysis that we've done as we try and organize ourselves to build up to operation in July.
Okay, and I believe that July was the target date then to start running your own operations, and we're on track for that, huh?
We're on track. We're feeling really good, and I'm happy to report that Park City Transit has actually been a great partner to us through this whole process, and I think both organizations are really focused on making sure that the customers don't feel any adverse impacts during and after the transition.
So is it safe to say that the only big buses we're going to see go between the Basin and Park City or is the Electric Express?
I don't think that is safe to say. I think it'll depend on what we decide to do, and that will certainly be coming out for public discussion in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay, because you'd always talked about using just smaller and perhaps a different type as opposed to fixed routes and smaller
vehicles.
Yeah, and
that definitely is going to be a part of the mix. I think what people are going to see is a variety of different vehicles that are really specifically tailored to the service we're trying to provide by neighborhood. But again, the public will be seeing that in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Caroline, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Caroline Rodriguez is Summit County's regional transportation planner. This is KPCW Park City.